Welcome to the Hope for the Animals podcast, a project of compassionate living. I'm your host, Hope Ohanek, and you can learn more about this podcast and other projects of compassionate living at our websites. You can find those links in the show notes. Today's podcast is focused on an important subject, and that is the animal liberation movement as a social justice issue. Connecting veganism to other social justice causes, I feel, is very important. Seeing our movement as part of the broader landscape of systematic oppressions that cause suffering to so many, human and non-human alike, is, I believe, critical to our success. And today we have Zane McNeil to help us understand this complicated topic. I hope you had a chance to listen to our last episode, episode 95, with Vasile Stanescu. Not only was that a very wonderful episode, at the end of the episode, I asked Vas, after we had, you know, really dug into greenwashing, really unpacked the subject of greenwashing, I asked him what the solutions were. And, you know, I was expecting answers like rewilding or legislation around the farm bill or something like that. But what he said was, he said that it is critical for us to see the vegan movement as a social justice issue. And he talked about access to food and food deserts and environmental racism. And while I could see someone, maybe their first reaction might be something like, well, what does that have to do with greenwashing? You know, I was like, yes, because that, yeah, that has everything to do with it. We have to come into our own as a viable social justice cause, targeting the causes of all systematic oppressions together. But how do we do that? There's no simple answer, but the stars were aligned that Zane happened to be our next guest because they can really help us to go a bit deeper into understanding this issue. So this episode, I think, is a very fitting progression to how Voss ended the last show. It's really one of the things I love about having this podcast. There are so many other perspectives beyond my own that are so valid and so formative to our movement. And I think that they also help me to see outside my own assumptions. They help me to formulate my thoughts and think about our movement deeply, how I speak about our movement. So I'm learning right along with you. So thank you for being here, for broadening your perspective today. So let's jump right into this important discussion. All right, so I am honored to be joined by Zane McNeil. Zane is a scholar, activist, and chair of the National Lawyers Guild's Animal Liberation Committee. They have worked closely with the Institute of Critical Animal Studies, the ICAS, and have published chapters in the ICAS's collections, including Vegans on Speciesism and Ableism, Eco-Ability Voices for Disability and Animal Justice, and Expanding the Critical Animal Studies Imagination, Essays on Solidarity and Total Liberation. He's also edited Queer and Trans Voices, Achieving Liberation Through Consistent Anti-Oppression, Vegan Entanglements, this is the second book now, Vegan Entanglements, Dismantling Racial and Carceral Capitalism, and Building Multi-Species Resistance Against Exploitation, Stories from the Front Lines of Labor and Animal Rights. And that one is forthcoming. Welcome to the podcast, Zane.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. Well, you have a huge body of work. There is a lot of publications. You've done some amazing collections, anthologies, and we're going to get into all of that. But we like to start by getting to know you a bit, and we want to know when and why you went vegan.
Yeah. So I'm from Morgantown, West Virginia. And I remember being probably around like six or seven. I was in Charlestown at the time. It's in the Eastern Panhandle, and they have this huge casino and horse tracks, horse racing tracks. And I really liked horses growing up, right? And so I went to the horse track, and one of the horses broke their leg while racing on the racetrack, and they came out and shot them. And that was really hard for me, even though my mom made sure I didn't see it, and we raced out. I still heard it, right? And it was also very funny because we didn't have like aquariums or anything in Morgantown. So we would go to like, I liked fish too. So we would go to this fish farm where it just had like big, I don't know, like pools, I guess, like cement pools of thousands and thousands of fish being farmed. And there'd always be dead fish on the top of the fish farms. And so like when I think back about why I became vegan, I think about these little instances where it's just kind of like death is everywhere, right? And even as a kid, you know, you don't want to hurt animals. Like most children want to be vegetarian, right? But there is this carnism, right? In the words of Melanie Joy, or like speciesism that you're kind of indoctrinated to, that you do eat animals. And my mom was vegetarian before I was born. So she, you know, would always want me to eat like veggie hot dogs instead of real hot dogs because she knew how gross they were. And being from West Virginia, I would want to go camping for Thanksgiving, right? But we wouldn't go because there was so much hunting. We have actually like the longest Thanksgiving break because the school bus drivers refuse to work because it's hunting season.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And when I was in 7th grade, my principal in my school would take apples the students wouldn't eat and then use them in his yard to bring deer in to shoot them. And so I remember putting a petition together, right? Because I turned vegetarian. I tried in 6th grade, but you don't realize how animal products are in everything, right? You're eating onion soup and then suddenly it has beef broth, right? It's very hard as a child to realize how it's in everything, right? And so like that was my first petition when I was a kid in 7th grade. And they stopped the practice. And then when I was
Wait,
14,
what was the petition for?
it was to get the principal to stop using these apples from students to put in his yard to shoot deer and kill deer with.
Oh, that's so
And it
sweet.
was
I
really
love
cute
that.
because I think I misspelled about half the words in that.
Oh.
But I remember going around and getting like dozens of signatures and then handing it. I was like, when I was like 12, it was very
Wow.
cute.
That's great.
And when I was 14, PCRM did this, it's like 30-day vegan kickstart for your health, right? And they had all the recipes. And so my mom and I got my mom to do it too, went vegan for 30 days. And I used to have really bad year-round allergies. It was such a snotty kid. It was really gross. And like I couldn't breathe. And then I must have been allergic to dairy or something, but it cleared up all my allergies and I just
Wow.
felt really good. And that's when I started learning about like reading Carol Adams' Sexual Politics of Meat, you know, and thinking through feminist works around vegan feminism, because my mom was an eco-feminist. And so like I grew up reading Greta Garde around this time and all these Val Plumwood. Like I was like 14 reading all these vegan feminist, vegetarian feminist theorists. And
Wow.
so I started realizing how harmful the dairy industry was too. So like a mix of feeling really good on it, plus thinking through my own feminist identity as a young kid who wasn't out yet, right? And being racist. My mom stayed vegetarian and I stayed vegan. And I've been vegan now for 14 years.
So you went vegan when you were 14.
Yep. So I
Wow.
was vegetarian about 2 or so years before that. And I was, you know, when you, I feel like new vegans, when they recognize how it's in this in everything, right? Like not just the actual animal products, but just like these structures of violence, right? How it's like weird to be vegetarian or vegan. Like I was bullied, you know, as a kid, in like middle school for being vegetarian. And then, you know, we would have in high school, we had like the frog unit, right? And I was able to get like a religious exemption, which so many kids can't, right? But like knowing that down the hall, people were dissecting these animals, like it was very hard for me, and my mental health. Once I realized that people I loved, right, were still part of the system that was so violent, and that almost every surface in the world has some kind of death on it, right? And so I really went headfirst into organizing. I started like a club on campus in high school, continued to do that throughout college. So I've been doing this work for a long time, and I've never disconnected it from all these other problems in the world, right? Because I, like I mentioned, when I started going vegan, I was also reading all these vegetarian feminist work, and then I was learning about environmental racism and doing work on that, and especially in West Virginia, where we're such a an extractive zone. We have a lot of chicken farms in the Eastern Panhandle that pollute the water. And so really around this time, it was a very radical awakening for me, because I always wanted to make the world a better place, you know, or whatever that meant to me as a kid. But then I really saw veganism and vegan politics and vegan organizing as a way to do this, to touch on all of these issues, right? That because it was connected to workers' rights, because it was connected to environmental racism, environmental degradation, like health epidemic, all of that could be solved in my mind through vegan outreach. And so that's really what started my work in vegan animal advocacy.
So, Zane, you have written and edited several books on the connection of veganism with numerous other issues and other oppressions. But before we get into specifics, like the specific topics of your books, I want to start broadly. And you have a quote in one of your books. You say, "I was drawn to animal rights activism because it exists at the intersection of injustices that I oppose, those of global climate change, environmental racism, farm worker struggles, and non-human animal abuse." Talk about why you feel it's important to connect social justice issues with veganism and look at these issues more systematically rather than focusing on animal rights alone.
Yeah, so it always has made sense to me. I think because someone who automatically is at these intersections, I personally feel affected for it. It's easier for me to visualize. Like I mentioned, you know, I faced a, when I was coming into my identity of as a vegan child, I also was trying to work through my understanding of gender and sexuality, which is very difficult. And then also thinking through living in a space where in Appalachia, there's a lot of environmental degradation. There's a lot of just using the region as a way to extract and exploit from it. And so having these kind of politicized identities that either were geographic or personal or political for me, they all seemed really interconnected. And so I think part of it was the way I was raised. Also, is this because my mom did a lot of work on during the HIV and AIDS epidemic, and then also around pregnancy and pregnancy criminalization and health work and ecofeminist work. And so it would have been hard for me to disentangle and see it in veganism as completely separate already. But I think I was able to see veganism, as I mentioned before, as a way to try to target all of these issues. And so when I came up to Julie Feliz, who is a Black Indigenous non-binary activist who coined the term consistent anti-oppression, it just all made sense to me. I wanted to work with them. It's just that, yeah, these structures of oppression, which include speciesism, racism, ableism, and sexism, just makes sense to be entangled, right? The same forces that are trying to extract as much as they can from the earth or from the animals, right, are already entangled with what I work in my second book, in white supremacy and capitalism. And so animal liberation, because of these histories of extraction that are reified in our current structures, in my opinion, cannot be achieved without building solidarity with other social justice movements. And there's multiple vegans of color, like AFCO or Breeze Harper, Lori Kimmel Alexander, Christopher Sebastian, who are really adamant in this, right? This isn't a new idea. It comes from these mostly Black vegan communities that also have been politicized and are at the margins of the movement, and also face these intersecting oppressions, that recognize that without actually engaging in a consistent anti-oppression approach, it might actually reify the oppressive structures that we are trying to dismantle, right? So in my work, I really try to bring vegan leftists who are already interested in social and environmental issues into this conversation around animal liberation and speciesism, because I argue that you can't affect change for one issue without also affecting change for animals, right? Because animals face some of the most egregious marginalization and harm, especially by numbers, by the effect of the exploitation and harm, than almost any group, if not the most harmed group of all, which are entangled with these systems that are also harming humans. And so if we approach things from a single issue way, this not only results in a marginalization of non-humans because we're not actually targeting the systems that are leading to their consumption and oppression, but also to a detrimental effect of our movement, that you need to work for all social movements and all liberatory structural change to dismantle these systems that cause this oppression, or else we aren't able to do anything to help the non-humans we say we're trying to help.
Really well said. So you mentioned consistent anti-oppression, and I want to talk about some of these terms because, these are terms that people may not be familiar with that are new to them. So can you define consistent anti-oppression and also total liberation and maybe any others that you think would be important to define?
Yeah. So, like I mentioned before, consistent anti-oppression is a term that was coined by Julia Feliz, who also is at these intersections of multiple forms of oppression. And so, I'm going to read a passage that they wrote in Queer and Trans Voices in our introduction that really defines their perspective on what consistent anti-oppression is and why it matters. So while justifiably invested in breaking down a specific form of supremacy on the behalf of non-human victims, speciesism, mainstream veganism is primarily driven by a single lens viewed by the most privileged in a hierarchical society. Mainstream, which often is equated to white, cis, etc., veganism has managed to flip the script within a speciesist supremacist hierarchy. However, it has done so while ensuring the most privileged remain at the top, meaning white, cis, male, able-bodied, straight, and human, while moving non-humans up the supremacist ladder above marginalized groups. In essence, mainstream veganism prioritizes the violence perpetuated against non-human animals above all other marginalized people, without recognizing how our speciesist society also harms the environment, slaughterhouse workers, low-income communities who live near factory farms and suffer from health issues, and how the most privileged has historically harmed now vulnerable communities, including queer people, while proclaiming these groups are now responsible ethically to undo the harm against the one chosen group. So consistent anti-oppression really recognizes that these systems like ableism, speciesism, white supremacy, cis-hetero patriarchy are all interconnected across all movements. And so that's also true in the vegan world, that we reify these oppression by not targeting it. So internally in our organizations and our work, if we don't recognize how these are all entangled with each other, we're not able to undo them internally or externally, which inhibits our ability to create the change we actually want to see. Total liberation, from my understanding, it comes from a different space. So consistent anti-oppression comes from mostly Black vegan communities, non-binary, Afro-Indigenous vegan spaces, thinking through how white supremacy is entangled with capitalism and speciesism, particularly around the construction of the human, which Aff and Silk Co. have written a lot about. Total liberation, from my perspective as being part of ICAS, comes from mostly white anarchists, thinking through how you can't work towards the liberation of one group without working towards another. And so while a lot of it is very similar, I think it really depends on which community you're working from and which kind of genealogy of thought you're bringing into it. So I most felt at home with this idea of consistent anti-oppression, especially because as a queer and trans person who saw those identities as very interconnected to my veganism and my anti-speciesist liberation work, kind of saw it entangled and netted with each other. Total liberation, I think, comes from a very similar spot, but from a different community, arguing that if you are, for example, a leftist that is fighting for all of these social human causes or environmental causes, but then leave out animals, you're not able to do the work you want to do. So very similar ideas, but just different communities, I think, and a different genealogy of thought.
Fascinating. All right. Well, so you say in your introduction of the edited volume, Vegan Entanglements, and we'll get into the details of that book later, but staying broad, so you say in the introduction, and I'll quote you, "The animal advocacy movement is at a crossroads." And you go on to say, that there's a quote, growing schism between advocates that view connecting animal liberation to other issues of social justice as diluting the message of animal rights, and other animal advocates who argue for a more consistent vision of anti-oppression. Can you talk more about this divide and how and if we can bridge that divide?
Yeah, so at the time when I started working on that collection, I was employed at the Animal Legal Defense Fund, and which is a nonprofit that works to represent animals and increase the rights of animals across the law. So we do a lot of they did a lot of work around trying to target factory farming or roadside zoos and that sort of thing. But at the same time, I was onboarded right before George Floyd was murdered in 2020, and ALDF has been critiqued by different anti-carceral scholars because they work very closely with the police, similar to the ASPCA. ALDF has a whole quote-unquote criminal justice arm of the organization. And in that summer of 2020, I feel like there was really a reckoning that happened with the animal advocacy space, where a lot of organizations came out with statements in support of Black Lives Matter. And really tried to recognize their own equity issues within their organizations. And so a lot of these organizations made concrete commitments around DEI concerns, right? And there was also this DEI turn, as I like to call it, in 2020, that was not just the animal advocacy or nonprofit space, but really a moment of reckoning within the US in general around these equity and justice concerns that were really voiced from this moment. And so at the ALDF during this time, they refused to make a statement in support of Black Lives Matter despite staff really pushing for it. And then they made a statement, but it was very whitewashy and sort of seemed pro-police since they did a lot of carceral prosecutorial work with police departments. And staff were really enraged by this, right? There wasn't this accountability to the harm ALDF might have caused in the past with some of our campaigns, as well as trying to restructure the organization with these DEI concerns and commitments in mind for the future. And so just people were very upset about this. And so I recognize this moment of some organizations really refusing to recognize why Black Lives Matter and commitments to Black liberation matter to the vegan space, right? And we hear this all the time is that we're here for the animals in the best light possible. The idea is that it's necessary for us to our movement to focus singularly on animals because otherwise we can't create change. And this schism that I started recognizing, right, was between these organizations and these movements that really recognize that that's not really how the world works. Like I was mentioning, the work of Afanasil Coe, Breeze Harper, Julie Feliz, Lori Kim Alexander, Christopher Sebastian, these Black vegans, academic scholars, and activists have really asserted that because we don't live in compartmentalized lives, and because speciesism and the mechanics of animal slaughter and just the horrible violence of these systems are entangled, right, with these other structures. And I think that's most visible with slaughterhouse workers. And environmental racism for these communities that live near these slaughterhouses and meatpacking plants. And so during COVID, slaughterhouse workers were put in a really dangerous situation where there were not these safety precautions in place. And many, many slaughterhouse workers started getting COVID and dying, right? And Venceremos and other organizations really wanted to do like a boycott of meat consumption, saying, "Mike, our people are dying, our communities are being harmed." And at before 2020, there was a vilification of slaughterhouse workers, specifically by vegan spaces, saying, "Oh, well, they're killing animals, they're doing this cruelty," and working with police and prosecutors, work like doing these undercover investigations, and then trying to get prosecutions of individual workers that allegedly were cruel to animals. Instead of recognizing the structural issues and PTSD and violence, and recognizing slaughterhouse workers as a potential ally to our movement. And one of my favorite scholars who has a chapter in my upcoming book, Haley Huguette, has written for Current Affairs on why the vegan movement was hurting its own cause. And this was around 2020. by vilifying slaughterhouse workers instead of working with labor organizations. There was also around 2020 this work, I think, for Civil Eats, this piece on Civil Eats about white supremacy and racism in the vegan movement, these really structural problems. And so I saw this as a turn where either we were not going to be able as a movement to achieve our missions while causing this harm and vilifying potential allies in our advocacy. And so internally, externally, in our messaging and our strategy, it was necessary for these organizations to listen to their staff who understood these structures and say, no, we can't do the work we want. We can't achieve our missions for these non-human animals without paying attention, without working with other advocacy organizations, without building partnerships, without doing collaborative campaigns. Because we don't live siloed lives, and speciesism affects everything, is entangled with everything. And so we can't just focus on one campaign that may harm other communities, other marginalized communities, because then we're actually reifying the harm that we say we're trying to dismantle. And so what I really wanted to do with vegan entanglements is explicitly show how white supremacy, capitalism, and speciesism are entangled across pretty much every sector, and say, hey, organizations, advocates, we can't do this work that you say you want to do without building power together. And so that's sort of the premise that I've built my work on.
Yeah, I believe, I want to believe that the majority of ethical vegans who are vegan for the animals, I don't believe that they want to see a world where everyone's eating veggie burgers and everything has gone, KFC is vegan and Burger King's vegan, all the food is vegan. But there's still horrible oppressions of racism and police brutality and war and, attacks on marginalized communities, all of that. I don't think that's the world that the majority of ethical vegans want. Of course, they, are concerned about suffering for everyone, human and non-human. But I think that, we've gotten in this mindset that we're working on animal issues. We need to focus on the animals. Nobody else is focusing on the animals, and the other people are doing the human work, and human oppression and other social issues, and it'll all come out in the wash, right? But not realizing just how connected it all is, how if we don't pay attention to the other issues, that we run the risk of, doing and saying and whatever, doing the wrong things and making everything worse. So I love this work that you're doing. I think it's incredibly important. And I think that we, as a vegan community, need to understand that, that what we do can affect so many other aspects of suffering in the world.
I feel like my work, I really hope, is seen as such a dedication, right? Because I've personally faced a myriad of different issues in the vegan spaces, right? Like PTSD alert, but like I've faced like sexual assault, transphobia, union busting, a lot of retaliation, like a lot of harm in these spaces. And I feel like that's not unusual, right? There's so many activists in these spaces that have faced similar issues. And maybe the reasons vegans don't know the names Afensil Kaur or Brace Harper or Julie Feliz or Lori Kim Alexander or Christopher Sebastian is because we are pushed to the margins, right? Because of our other identities and for trying to call in these organizations that we really, really want to work with. And we these movements that we care so much about, right? I spent the last, oh, 16 so years, a long time, right? Doing this work, doing grassroots work, doing public policy work, doing legal work around animal liberation, this activist scholarship, right? And there's a huge community of folks doing similar work to me, that have faced similar harms. And so really, the dedication to stay in the space and to do this work is to call in and say, we do recognize these issues, and together we can make our movement healthier and safer for activists at the same time as making our strategies and our work more effective and less harmful towards outside communities. And so, if we really are a movement committed to liberation and justice, we have to make sure that we're not complicit in creating internal hierarchies and harming marginalized communities for the world and for ourselves as a movement, for the animals.
Well, getting into your books, let's talk more specifically about one of your books. So I want to start with the edited volume that you did with Julia Felice. It's called Queer and Trans Voices: Achieving Liberation Through Consistent Anti-Oppression. And there's some really fantastic essays in this book. Talk about this book. Why do you feel that it was important to collect these essays and talk about this connection?
Yeah, so as a queer and trans person, around 2018, I became really involved with this work around queer Appalachia, and I had like a zine called Marks in the Mountains, and was really found a community in this kind of Instagram and like internet space, and I found a home and a language to understand identity and sexuality. But at the same time, there was such anti-vegan sentiment in those spaces, in a lot of ways because of the way speciesism indoctrinates leftists, and that's what the total liberation framework's for, right? Is saying you're right on so many things, but at the same time, you can't do this work without also trying to liberate animals. So partially because of that, and partially because of the harm the vegan community has done around these entanglements of oppression, right, to marginalized communities. And so I really wanted to draft this book with this community in mind, right? Is these are my people, right? These are my friends. This is my community. I really want them to understand that as a queer and trans person, as an LGBTQIA person, it's so necessary to fight for us as well as fight for non-human animals. And so I reached out to Sanctuary Publishers, which was run by Julia Felice, who had done great work around vegans of color specifically and community projects around that. And I mentioned to them that it's necessary for a community to understand these intersections. And I also want queer and trans folks who have kind of been pushed to the margin in these and not platformed to say, give them a space to say, yes, I'm vegan. This is why it matters to me. And so it's a mix of academic and personal essays, call-ins for non-vegan leftists, as well as calls out for vegan spaces that end up being homophobic and transphobic. And it ends up being a great mix of thinkers and activists around the world. I'm really proud of it.
So I wonder if you could maybe get a little specific, because I could see vegans and vegan advocates saying, "Well, when are we homophobic? You know, we're so open, and you know, I don't understand how this is happening, or how are we oppressing the queer community?" You know, so I wonder if you have any specifics that you might want to share, so you could explain how this happens.
Yeah, so I think a big premise that we introduced in the introduction, and then a few of the authors, including Margaret Robinson, who's an Indigenous vegan, really hones in on is how a lot of the structures that harm animals are also colonialist and come from a history of colonization. So we can't achieve liberation for animals without also dismantling these structures that come from our history of colonialization. And so we come up with this term called cis-heteropatriarchal speciesism, which is a huge mouthful, but it explores these intersections and just how transphobia and homophobia, quote unquote, like animalizes queer people by excluding LGBT people as the other, in addition to normalizing violence against other animals. And so we really do have like a call out for the queer community of saying that we have to work against our common system rooted in our own marginalization. But at the same time, with the vegan community, there is in a lot of ways, there's just like a knee-jerk reaction around villainizing non-vegans, especially non-vegans who are indigenous. And so really what the Margaret Robinson's chapter is about is recognizing how you can do vegan advocacy in a way that doesn't vilify and alienate Indigenous people and Black and Brown people. And so we have a good mix of chapters on not just the microaggressions people might face working in the vegan movement, but really these larger structural issues and strategic campaign structure, right? Where you have to think through white supremacy and anti-indigeneity and capitalism, right? When thinking through how to best achieve liberation for animals. And that goes back to these roots, right? So much of my work is how these harms are rooted all in the same thing. And so you can't disentangle one from the other.
Yeah, I think it's really important for vegans to consume other media around other social issues, not to just stay in the animal rights bubble all the time and try to, get into other spaces. And I listen to a few podcasts outside of animal issues, and one that I listen to is called Gender Reveal. I really love it. I highly recommend it. The host is Tuck Woodstock, and it's focused on trans issues. And they just had a guest on, Raquel Willis, recently, who said something that I really resonated with. And Raquel said something to the, I'm paraphrasing here, but something to the effect of that she feels like she's living in a world that's not ready for me. That's what she said. I feel like I'm living in a world that's not ready for me. And I think that vegans feel that as well. And not to compare the degree of feeling separated from society or the degree of pain or oppression that the queer and trans community faces. That's very, very different from vegans. And the separation, again, is, I'm sure, very different too. But in a way, I felt a real kinship when Raquel said that we're kind of ahead of our time, vegans and the queer community, and that we live in a world that's not ready for us. And I thought that was kind of an interesting connection. I don't know if you have anything to say about that or if you can think of other connections that these two communities have.
Yeah, so I've written about the similar, like I mentioned before, I was bullied a lot in high school and middle school for being vegan. And there's been different people who've written on this idea that being vegan is similar to coming out of the closet when you come out as vegan, right? And
Yeah.
this otherization as a vegan and as a queer person in my experience is very similar. In one of the chapters by Mo Constantine, they talk about like queer people, animal liberation activists face great resistance from society because their assertion of our kinship with non-human animals challenge the carefully constructed dichotomies that justify society's manner of existence. And so in their chapter and in my experience, it's this very similar work to otherization, right? Vegans are otherized, queer people are otherized, and all of that is based on what Julie and I term as cis heteropatriarchal speciesism, right? Is that this otherization of animals in these spaces that make them easier to exploit, this otherization of vegans that can allow prosecutors to label them as terrorists or imprison them, right? And then this interlocking oppression of racialized people, women and queers and non-human animals really just shows how these different systems are similar and entangled and how we need to work towards collective freedom for all of us.
I feel very strongly about trans issues. I love reading about it, learning about it. It's like that feeling you get, that emotion you get with the animals and how you just want to protect them. I feel that same way about the trans community. I get that like protective mom, like mad, thing around the
I think
trans
it's
community.
really similar. A lot of my legal work I've been moving into recently is around bodily autonomy, which includes gender-affirming care, because we have seen a huge backlash for gender-affirming care for minors, trans people who are incarcerated, and then poor trans people on Medicaid, as well as trying to push, state legislators are trying to push anti-trans gender-affirming care bans up to the age of 26, so trans adults,
Oh,
as well as the in tandem attacks on reproductive freedom and abortion care. So
oh.
both of these similar bodily attacks on bodily autonomy, which for me does feel really similar to my work with animal liberation, right? Because in a lot of ways, I think everyone, including non-human animals, deserve the freedom to make decisions around their bodily autonomy, right? And
Yeah.
obviously, animals who are caged and exploited and then killed and eaten do not have that ability to have any bodily autonomy, especially when we go back to thinking about like the dairy industry, right? And the forcible insemination of animals who then become pregnant to create milk, right? Or to produce other animals that will be killed for slaughter, become dairy cows also, and don't have the freedom of choice about parenting or their children that are taken away right away. And so a lot of my work around trans and reproductive freedom is also informed by my vegan advocacy.
So your other edited volume, and we have so much to get to. You have such a broad body of work, but I do want to talk about now your book called Vegan Entanglements: Dismantling Racial and Carceral Capitalism. So this book, when I read it this year, just opened a whole new world of fascinating and horrific connections for me. It was really, really eye-opening and informative. And there's numerous aspects to this issue. There's just these essays cover a wide range of areas, but of course, a common theme. And some of the topics, like there's forced captivity, like our prison industrial complex reflecting our animal industrial complex, exploitation of farm workers, processing plant and slaughterhouse workers, undercover agents infiltrating the animal rights and environmental groups. That was really interesting. Can you just give us an overview of the issues explored in this book and maybe define carceral capitalism and carceral veganism?
Yeah, thank you. I know it seems so academic. After this book came out, I got a little bit of a backlash on the title. It was very particular why I used racial and carceral capitalism. But it does, I think, sometimes alienate readers because it's a bit of a mouthful. And so in Queer and Trans Voices, there was a chapter by Lee Kurtz, who is fantastic writer, but they wrote on towards an anti-carceral queer veganism. And they were talking about the way the vegan movement has sometimes aligned with police and prosecutors, as I mentioned earlier, and immigration, like ICE officials, to deport and arrest and criminalize mostly low-income people of color, and why that's problematic, right? And so their chapter was so fantastic. And this, like I mentioned, that we're in, it was around 2020, and there's this huge discussion around police brutality and racism, and especially around COVID-19 and immigration and slaughterhouse workers. I wanted to curate this collection of thinkers and activists and writers and scholars on these topics, especially around this carcerality that we see in and this punitive approach to what we see as justice sometimes in the vegan movement, which counts incarcerating, criminalizing, and deporting low-income people of color as a win for the animals. And I had just edited this, I'd reviewed, I copy edited a collection that had come out from the same publisher, Lantern Publishing, this book by Peter Brandt around the same time. Peter was a, or probably still is, a HSUS lawyer, and he had worked on one of these cases that led to the incarceration and criminalization of a slaughterhouse or meatpacking worker. And in his autobiography, which I copy edited for Lantern, he really was talking about how he felt like he had made a mistake in that campaign strategy and what he wished he had done different. And so there's been, I think, a larger dialogue around these carceral themes, this working with police, that you sometimes see these nonprofits like ASPC and ALDF, of working in tandem with ICE officials, and really how that not only harms marginalized people, but again, doesn't affect the kind of change, the structural change that we want to see for animals. Because in these undercover investigations, even if you hand them over to prosecutors, the prosecutors are not going to bring charges against management or the industry, right? Which these very legal systems of harm towards animals are occurring, right? There's not a lot of legal protections for animals. What they're going to do is say there was a bad apple and then go after this one person. And so there's trying to illustrate that speciesism is so embedded with these logics that want to criminalize Black and Brown people deport immigrants and then make money off of their labor, especially during COVID, which I think really made the invisible visible with how expendable these workers were and how their lives mattered less or as less as the animals they were killing. These intersecting systems of carcerality in the prison industrial complex with the police, with prosecutors, with ICE and immigration officials, I wanted to show is entangled in some of the work that we do in the nonprofits, as well as why it's necessary for us to challenge these systems while also working towards animal liberation. And so the chapters that are part of this collection talk about everything from, and they include different chapters from folks in India. They include someone who worked as a sanctuary worker at Farm Sanctuary around this idea of what sanctuary really means. Includes different writers from the UK and how police have, like you mentioned, infiltrated and targeted animal advocacy spaces. And so, and to folks like Nico Stubler, who had been arrested for doing animal liberation work. And in their chapter, they talk about how it really helped show them how we can't work with police that are also targeting us. And so this book is similar to Queering Trans Voices in trying to illustrate how these systems are entangled, platform voices that otherwise might not be able to be platformed, and then try to do a call in for nonprofit workers and organizations and advocates who, like at ALDF when I was working there, one of our marketing platforms and merchandise was Harm an Animal, Go to Jail, right? And so that was really what was under all of this for me. It was saying we're in this moment of time where organizations can't successfully do the work that we say we want to do if we're also saying, if you harm an animal, you go to jail, when that's ineffective. It doesn't actually curb animal abuse in any way. And this legal system that kills billions of animals a year in horrendous conditions, harms workers, harms local communities from environmental degradation, is not affected. And so vegan entanglements really works to say there's other ways out there, and this is what we need to do about it.
Yeah, I want to hone in on one aspect that you mentioned a bit about, but it's something that's always bothered me, and I've always thought about this, and now I have a name for it, carceral veganism, where we use the law to persecute farm workers, the farm animal workers, whenever there's an undercover investigation. And you know, and I think that these undercover investigations are incredibly important. Getting that footage is really powerful. What those activists go through is horrendous and, you know, frightening and awful and dangerous. So they get this footage, but then what happens is that everything gets focused on these individual workers, often from marginalized communities. Right. And they bear the brunt of the public outrage and they get animal cruelty charges. And it kind of allows for the company to push the blame away from them and onto these individuals and kind of wash their hands of it. Right. Kind of as a way to kind of desystematize the injustice. And it's always been so frustrating to me because I feel like the investigations are really powerful, but then the follow through or the outcome of what these big organizations that fund these investigations, it seems like their follow through is just so ineffective. You know, that these individuals get scapegoated and then the management and the owners and the company and the system itself just gets off the hook. They're able to point their finger and say, "Oh yeah, we don't approve of animal abuse. Go arrest those people. That's not us." And it just feels like a missed opportunity for me. It feels like what the message needs to be is, and therefore go vegan, therefore stop this horrible system, right? But that's not what ends up happening. So it's really frustrating.
Yeah, and I think it shows the limit of the law, right? So a lot of these organizations really want to figure out the way to limit animal abuse and exploitation in a way where so much of it's legalized, right? And they see punitive justice, working with prosecutors, working with police as a way to do that. because the legal system has legalized so much harm. And so I'm in law school currently, and I have a background in animal law, and I'm an animal law fellow currently, and I do a lot of work around this. But animal law as a system is property law, right? Because animals don't have their own autonomy under the law. If you don't want to work with property law, like nuisances or things like that, a lot of these organizations have said, oh, well, then we'll work with criminal law. But and they don't go after big ag, right? Because prosecutors don't want to do that. And it ends up harming the most marginalized that has the least political power. And it doesn't really protect animals. It does nothing but play into these systems of domination that opposes, you know, vegan organizers, that opposes non-human animals. There needs to be a different way that doesn't, that thinks through the way carceral logic's idea that putting people in jail is good for animals or good for the world, and really think through the way abolition is articulated, right? Because we talk about without having cages, we talk about the abolition of animal farming, right? The end of a practice, the end of caging animals, the end of this exploitation. But sometimes that doesn't go into thinking about abolition of prisons and the carceral immigration work and capitalism, which undermines all of this, right? The idea of everything being turned into a product for the accumulation of wealth, which William Horne, he was one of my favorite scholars. I've known him for a really long time. He's a historian. He is one of the first chapters, if not the first chapter in this. And he really talks about this, these so-called like meat barons. He comes from like this Reconstruction era historian perspective of if when we marginalize and harm laborers, we're not doing anything to help animals. We're just engorging the availability of cheap labor for these systems already. And so there has to be a different way to challenge and target this really, really horrible system that we're all trying to fight against. And I think part of that is coming from a consistent anti-oppression perspective. Haley Huguette, in my forthcoming book, talks about bringing in different entry points for union advocates, doing consumer boycotts, working with slaughterhouse workers for strikes, right? And really stopping this work. During 2020, one of the really cool things that ALDF did is they had a whistleblower network available for slaughterhouse workers who saw their industry as not keeping it up to COVID protocol, right? And working with them on their work. Public Justice did a wrongful death suit for a slaughterhouse worker during 2020 that died because of COVID and the lack of safety precautions. If we had worked with Venceremos when they did a call for a boycott of meat consumption, right? Because of slaughterhouse worker deaths. These are all spaces that we can build collaborative campaigns that not only work against these carceral logics, and do not harm marginalized communities, but also have a better chance of actually eroding and dismantling industrial agriculture.
Yeah, I was thinking about this, you know, going into our conversation, and it made me think about how this is so kind of similar to police brutality issues. And like right now, Elijah McClain, the murder of Elijah McClain, and there's all these trials happening. There's three officers and two paramedics that are all having separate trials for his death. This was in Colorado. And, you know, and this kid, it's just so heartbreaking because he was just this gentle soul. He would play violin for animals at the local animal shelter. He was vegetarian for the animals. And, you know, and not to diminish any person's experience with police brutality, you shouldn't have to be an animal lover to be treated with respect, right? But when you hear the tapes on the body cams, he's saying that he's an introvert. And I feel like that should have, you know, clued them in that he was possibly neurodivergent, you know, and to be treated differently. But anyway, one of the things
A
that,
really horrible case, especially being in Colorado now, right? And being near where the killing took place, knowing the attorneys that have worked on the wrongful death suit that just settled, and it being so cold, right? Like he was wearing a ski mask, because he had a disorder that made it necessary. But it's also freezing here, right? And everyone wears ski masks, right? And the amount of it's really, really horrible to be in. Near in the space and have this completely contextualized understanding of that atrocity right here.
Yeah.
Yeah, you listen to his last words and it's just so heartbreaking,
Yeah,
right?
awful. It's awful. But the thing that was interesting to me is how, there's these five people that are on trial involved in his death and, responsible for his death. But why, again, are we focusing on just these individuals, right? And not the culture or the policies, that caused those individuals to take those actions in the first place. I mean, if it's five people, obviously there is a systematic issue, right? And it just feels very paralleled to what we do with the undercover investigation issue.
Yeah, in New York City, I do writing, freelance journalism too, and they just had a settlement for the illegal arrests of multiple Black Lives Matter protesters. And as part of that settlement, it was supposed to be they would initiate different policy changes, right? Like kettling the practice of putting protesters in sort of a locked place, like a bridge, and then arresting all of them, right? Things that just really shouldn't be legal. And then with these pro-Palestine anti-Zionism protests in New York, they're doing the same thing even with the settlement. And so like that's the whole idea of reform versus abolition. And the work, the most of the authors, if not all of them in this collection, would say that the police and the prison industrial complex and the immigration industrial complex and the animal agriculture industrial complex, right, all of these systems need to be abolished because they aren't able to be reformed. And we need to dream different ways of creating better, healthier, safer spaces through mutual aid, through restorative justice, through holding our communities accountable.
Well, this is, also so important. I really appreciate this conversation so much. So, Zane, we do need to wrap up, and I wanted to ask you about the work you're doing now. Do you want to talk about what you have going on right now?
Yeah, thanks. So a lot of what I've been working on is thinking through how to bring consistent anti-oppression into other animal advocacy spaces in a more material way. So I do a little bit of like DEIJ consulting, thinking through justice and how to bring in these structural issues into organizations. And as part of that, I also have been working on this collection, which I mentioned a few times. It's forthcoming with Peter Lang Publishing on labor rights in AR. So really thinking through why labor organizing matters for vegan organizations and the animal advocacy sector generally, as well as bringing in folks to talk about their own personal experiences. And so, really excited for that collection. And that's the Building Multi-Species Resistance Against Exploitation collection that should be coming out in the next year or so.
So, Zane, I'm going to ask our last question. What gives you hope for the future?
It's a hard one, right? Because things right now feel really challenging
Yeah.
politically. But at the same time, I feel like there's an investment in our communities right now to do this work, right? And in a way that pre-2020 I didn't see. And there's activists who are really invigorated in trying to move our movement forward in a way that doesn't leave anyone behind. And so I think there's a dedication and a passion to want to do this work, to think through ways to liberate non-human animals in a way that doesn't harm anyone else. I'm really excited to see the ways in which our movement and the organizations in it work to do that.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much for the work you're doing. I think it is critical to our movement succeeding and our movement moving forward. And thank you so much for being on the podcast.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Hope for the Animals podcast, a project of compassionate living. So if you are a fan of YouTube, you can now listen to these podcasts on YouTube. I finally uploaded all 100 plus episodes to YouTube over the winter break. I know this is episode 96, but I have about 11 bonus episodes, so there are over 100 episodes. I've been wanting to do this for a long time. I tried to find a volunteer to do it, but it was just taking too long, just like years. So I finally just did it myself. I I Googled, how do you upload podcasts to YouTube on YouTube? So I figured it out and I learned that actually people listen to podcasts on YouTube more than they do on Spotify and a lot of the other podcast apps. So I hope to find a new audience there. Speaking of YouTube, the podcasts are on Compassionate Living's YouTube page, along with numerous wonderful videos of our past events, including this year's Humane Hoax Online Conference that happened earlier this month. I hope to have those videos posted by the time you're listening to this. We have each speaker's presentation separated out in a separate video, so you can watch just who you're interested in. You don't have to watch the whole conference. And there's videos, of course, from our past conferences there, powerful and relevant presentations. So go and check out our YouTube page. I'll put a link to that YouTube page in our show notes. Thank you so much for being interested in this very important topic. There are more podcast episodes on this subject, which is very broad. There's numerous angles and subjects within this subject. So if you go to our podcast website, there's a drop-down menu where I have episodes categorized, and there's a category called Anti-Oppression. And there you'll find several past episodes with informative guests. You can dig deeper into this topic, different aspects, different angles on this topic. Thank you for caring about all of those suffering, all sentient beings, human and non-human. Together, we can create a better world for everyone. So please live vegan.